All right, are we ready to start? Very good. All right, hi, my name is Dave Nolan. I am the audio archivist at the 92nd Street Y in New York City. Welcome to the afternoon session of Technical Topics. This afternoon we will have Richard Hess speaking on tape degradation factors and predicting tape life. We'll have Seth Winner speaking on Cedar retouch, and we will have Doug Pomeroy demonstrate how to play a record. Let me just give Richard's intro here. Richard has been involved with tape recording since he bought his first tape recorder in 1963 at the age of 11. He worked at ABC TV in New York from 1974 through 1981 as an audio video systems engineer. He designed ABC's first 8-track audio sweetening room, amongst other projects. During that period, he also recorded many concerts and services, as well as recorded or produced about a half dozen record albums for St. Thomas Church on 5th Avenue and 53rd Street. Two of these recordings were re-released on Priory Records out of the UK a few years ago. In 1981, Richard joined McCurdy Radio Industries in Toronto. They had supplied much of the audio equipment for the last large ABC project he worked on, and he thought it would be interesting to move to Canada and work on the other side for a while. When McCurdy was sold in 1983, Richard and his new bride went to Glendale, California to work for 21 years at National Teleconsultants, where he held various titles, including vice president and principal consultant. He worked on a variety of high-end design projects. In 1999, he had the opportunity to go public with the restoration of the 51 oldest tapes in the United States. And from then on, he returned to his early passion of tape recording. He was able to evaluate this as a second career by working part-time at tape restoration while working full-time for NTC. Tape restoration continued to excite him. In 2004, Richard and his wife decided it would be good to return to her hometown of Aurora, Ontario, and go into tape restoration full-time. He has been getting great customer feedback like, "You did a tremendous job of restoration, and the recordings sound even better than I remembered." And has been involved in researching, along with a host of others, the degradations of recording tape. And if you have not been to his website, richardhess.com/tape is possibly the single finest resource of technical issues having to do with tape that I know of in the world today. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Hess.
Thank you very much. Just follow all the links in the top bar, and you'll be surprised what's there, including a blog, which I don't contribute to, but if you very often. But if you want to know when it's updated, there's an RSS feed for it even. Today we're talking about tape degradation factors and predicting tape life. I hope the expanded paper will be out soon in the AES Journal, and they're still thinking about it. And from the 1999 AES Journal, when we talked about the Jack Mullen and Bill Palmer tapes, Dietrich Schuller on the same issue said, "The world's stock of audio recordings is estimated to be more than 50 mega hours of materials, and none of these recordings are on permanent carriers." Last fall, King's College London, as part of a seminar promotion, said 70% of all audiovisual material is under immediate threat of deterioration, damage, or obsolescence, and 70% of collection managers don't know it. So the challenge: archives hold tapes from the 1940s to the present, or new media at the present. The tapes are degrading. Few, if any, new playback machines are made. And there are multiple factors that we'll go into involved in the degradation. And really, it surprised me, only limited research has been done into the degradation of tapes. And recommendations for tapes may differ from those for film. There's been much more work done on film degradation and preservation. And unfortunately, as with film and negatives, photographic negatives, some tapes may degrade before it's their turn to be copied. So we're going to talk about all of those issues and how to manage some of them. Now, conceptual timeline, it's really conceptual, but the bluish chart is the analog recorder quality, and I'm showing that falling off in the future because spare parts are made of the rarest of all materials, unobtainium. And we're in the position now where we have to make parts or cobble together something that wasn't intended to be there. The tape quality got better before the present and is falling off because it's degrading. Digitization quality started out at zero in 1935, but sometime in the 50s, digitization started, and it may be getting just a little bit better. We have the Prism folks with new converters being shown, and then that's the pinnacle of stuff. But I think most converters today are adequate for digitizing most open reel tapes. So if you do an algebraic sum of all this, you end up with the yellow curve. So it's showing why now, and now can be loosely taken over a 10-year span or so, of why you should really be seriously considering digitizing your analog tapes. Now, looking at the components of a tape, and most of you are familiar with this, but just as a reminder, there's the binder oxide and lubricant are all on this side. There's the base film, and then some of the later mastering tapes have a back coating. And all of these contribute in varying degrees to tape degradation. Base film degradation modes. This is where you have to know what type of base film you have. Acetate can degrade from vinegar syndrome or brittleness, drying out, and shrinkage. Polyester can, some of the tapes can warp, especially with the thinner tapes that were done with tensilized rather than balanced polyethylene or phthalate film. And then PVC and paper can have slow weakening due to aging. With PVC, I've also noticed the potential for it to oxidize if left exposed. And on some of the magnetophone bond type L that dates from 1944-45, I've left some hubs out on display, and the first wrap is very brittle. So that to me would indicate that, you know, rapid exposure to the or long-term exposure to open air is causing a degradation in the PVC. Now that's a homogeneous tape, so it's not a base film coating. It's the oxide is in the PVC, and it's just one mixture. So for general degradation modes, and here we're showing acetate tapes both under reflected light and transmitted light. You all know you hold an acetate tape up to the light and you see light coming through it. Well, you can see when it's starting to spoke, you can clearly see dark spots as it's being deformed. And we have folded wraps as a good example here. And then reels can damage the tape as well. So acetate base film was used to produce tape about 1935 to 1972. The vinegar syndrome is slowed by freezing. We know that from film, but freezing is considered bad for the tape. So vinegar syndrome is left to advance, but it's doing so slower than the film. But Mike Casey and I have had long discussions as to whether vinegar syndrome will plateau or continue to the ultimate destruction of all acetate tapes. And we don't know the full time range of this, but chemically speaking, I think, and I don't know if Mike is fully aboard with this thinking, is that it will continue ultimately to the destruction of the tape. Canadian Conservation Institute, Joe Irachi, did a great thing on optical discs a couple of years ago, and he and I are talking about doing some research into freezing acetate tapes, to which I have collected some 1946 vintage Scotch tape and others that have already started to go vinegary, and we want to see what happens when it's frozen. We suspect that that may be the best choice, the lesser of two evils now that acetate is starting to go vinegary. Here's an example of a 1943-ish German tape, and it's this is actually a composite of two different reels, but here you could see the reel, corrosion around the windows formed by the acid, a blow up of the end of this spring here. You could see how the steel is got hairy rust on it, corrosion, and the screw is all corroded. And I don't know if you can see it in the projection, but the windows, these windows printed to the can it was in. So the acid coming off the tape was enough to discolor the paint on the can. Then on another reel, you could see the cracking in, and these are all little Photoshopped inserts, you can see the cracking on the tape from the shrinkage. Now, PVC and paper-based film, the degradation is not as fast as acetate, and paper in general is known to respond well to freezing. Again, we have the question about lubricants, though. And PVC has been generally stable, but that thing that I did mention, and also people are worried about the plasticizers coming out of PVC tape, which may be the thing that we're seeing. We're not sure. I mean, PVC tape is not very common. PVC tape was made from 43 to 72, and paper was made in the 40s and 50s. I don't have exact dates. Polyethylene terephthalate, that is the generic name for what was known as Mylar. Now, a lot of people in the 60s thought that Mylar was a better version of polyester, and Mylar is really just the DuPont trademark. It is the most stable and least problematic of the historic-based films. We're seeing PEN, polyethylene naphthalate, being used today, and I don't include that because that's mostly data tape, but PET is still widely used. But interestingly, it's hygroscopic, and it can move water to the back of the coatings as well as the edge of the coatings, taking in and off the reel. Binder failures. This is what, these are the real time bombs, other than vinegar syndrome and acetate. Soft binder syndrome is my term from my AES paper. The tape squeals and may leave some debris. Baking may or may not solve the problem, usually not. And if it does solve, it then is probably what we call sticky shed syndrome. And I'm looking at sticky shed as a subset of soft binder syndrome. They're all caused by moisture coming into the tape. And the moisture breaks down the binder, the polymer chains of the binder into shorter chains. And it gets rather nasty, but I'm not sure I can go into all the chemistry here. The polyester polyurethane binders suffer most. The glass transition temperature, which is another way of expressing Young's modulus in a way, is lowered as the tape degrades. And it's the temperature above which the substance becomes rubbery. It goes from a smooth to a rubbery surface, and it can be below room temperature. The Doug's Memorial 3M175 that he and a partner were transferring measured out just recently to having a glass transition temperature of 8 degrees Celsius. And one reel did not immediately respond at about, that should be 3 degrees Celsius, not Fahrenheit, but it did after several days of cold soak. Removing the moisture may raise the glass transition temperature somewhat, but the reactions, Bertram and Cudahy in their paper talked about the actions being reversible or the hydrolytic breakdown, but in a filled matrix, it's not really possible because once the bonds break, there's no way for the ends that broke to get back together. You know, they just can't find themselves. So now, one of the things that I had been thinking about for a while, and when I was talking to Rick Bradshaw about this, when he confirmed that the glass transition temperature could go below room temperature, one solution suggested itself. And you could tell this is in Canada because we get our milk in polyethylene sacks as opposed to cartons or things. But anyway, I chose the A77 because it fit in the fridge without having to take all the food out. And it also was a worst case because it does not have a terribly friendly tape path. And so I thought if it worked on the A77, it would work on an A810, and I now have a dedicated fridge nearer the transfer suite with an AA10 and a dragon in it, because it really works. It worked with 3M-175, it worked with Sony PR-150, and both of those tapes were really previously unplayable, did not respond to baking, and only partially responsive to re-lubrication. Now, some of you may have seen, I have Marie O'Connell's write-up on my website of her wet playing technique with isopropanol, and I'm hypothesizing at this moment that the wet playing does two things. It forms a lubricant layer that helps with the rubberiness not sticking to the head and squealing. You know that the squeal is a stick slip, and it's really a high-frequency modulation of the audio as the tape starts and stops at a microscopic level. So that's really what you're hearing. Although you're actually hearing the tape start and stop as well, because you can audibly hear it even with the audio turned down. But it's also modulating the audio, which means you can't take it out with any post-processing. But it also, I think, because the isopropanol is evaporating, is lowering the head tape interface temperature. And so that's helping getting the temperature lower. So that's why I think that her solution was truly brilliant. And really, it was one of the stepping stones that led the way to us thinking this through. Now, for the Revox, all heads and guides were in place for the test, and we used the high tension, the large reel setting, just to make it a tougher test. And the environment in the fridge was approximately 4 degrees C, 25% relative humidity. Mark Durenberger in Minneapolis had some tapes that were from the Pavitt Museum that had the same type of squeal. And in last November, now November, Minneapolis, Minneapolis, November, he put the tape machine on his balcony, ran the wire through the door, and the tape played fine. So we're getting confirmation. And the one that took 2 days cold soak to work did work. And that was with the Library of Traditional Music at Indiana. They brought one of their 810s over to a cold room. And so now there is an alternate approach, which Doug, I think, has a photo of someplace that he can show later. The 3M Scotch 175 did respond to cleaning, removing all stationary guides and heads except the playhead, and reduced tension. And I was able to do that, and Doug was able to do it. But the Sony PR-150 did not respond to this at room temperature. So both of these will work for 175. The Sony PR-150 only worked with the Coldplay. So sticky shed syndrome, another bomb. Back-coated mastering tapes, the two coatings appear to interact. And this is, I think, the basis of Charlie Richardson's hypothesis that he gave at the AES last October and previously at ARSC in Austin about removing the back coating, which is a scary thought in my mind, but it does remove the interaction. Sticky shed leaves hard to remove debris, and the layers sometimes adhere to each other with blocking and pitting. So therefore, if you want to try sticky shed, be very careful with the cold playing. I've only had marginal success because the debris levels are much higher than the non-sticky shed version of soft binder syndrome. Sticky shed does respond to baking, but remember the tapes are not as good as new, and multiple baking is thought to possibly degrade the tape. And when it was invented, but the inventors saw it as a last-ditch effort to recover content. And we think it's getting worse with time. The chemistry would seem to lead us to that. But, and as I said before, baking does not relink the chains, but temporarily raises the TG, glass transition temperature, and appears to reduce pinning. Rick Bradshaw, who was the guy who was able to unwind the Challenger tape after it sat on the ocean floor, said this about a hypothesis. All the back coatings are far more binder-rich than the magnetic coatings, and their modulus is half that of the magnetic coatings, due to the very poor reinforcement of carbon black. So the back coating has more binder in it and is already softer, is what that says. I believe what happened is the back coating and mag coatings are compressed into a high pressure contact during storage, and that's especially near the hub where we see more pinning. And since the binders are both essentially the same, they intermix and entangle over time, such that when you pull them apart, some of the mag coating and some of the back coating are transferred to each other as they separate. That's why you get pullouts when you pull a horribly sticky shed tape apart off the reel. Now, with some pinning, I have found playing it out at 1 7/8 on a separate transport will often help a lot, but not with fully not with fully involved sticky shed because you've got all the other stuff happening, but with like 3M201, you can solve the pullouts that way. But going back to this, the last paragraph, this deposit is above the normal surface. Think of it as mountains on the top of the tape. And it's clipped off onto the head during tape motion. Now, one of the things we know from Bouchon, who used to be a partner, worked with Bradshaw in the IBM labs, who wrote the compendium, 1,200 pages of the tribology of magnetic storage, talks all about the localized heating, and the frictional heating is enough to make the debris melt to the head, and that can be very difficult to clean off. This is the best description of sticky shed that I have ever seen and makes us think about how to get around it. Pinning and blocking. Now, there's one. Is Nathan here? Nathan Georgidis? Well, this was his tape from the seminar a year ago, and here's pinning, and we've since learned that 1 7/8 playback would probably not have caused 1 7/8 winding would probably not have caused this. The binder oxide is ripped out. Near the hub, it increases. Cold soak, slow unwinding, and rehumidification may break it, and it may happen with sticky shed tapes. Binder-based adhesion failure. This was seen. I've only seen it on a cassette, a Type 3, which was discontinued. They're prone to this. And it may respond to cold soaking. We didn't try it on this because we weren't sure what we were dealing with, and it was already too involved by the time we got to the section. Factors influencing degradation. The first thing that happens is, what did the chemists who were sort of guessing at this, how did they formulate and select the components? Then the components can degrade or fail over time. There can be manufacturing defects or tolerances on a batch-to-batch basis. Storage conditions are an issue. Playback without proper conditioning is an issue, and playback on defective equipment. How do you prioritize for preservation? The facet tool that we've heard a lot about here is my first choice for a large collection. Identifying at-risk tape types and batches, running changes in the tapes may make this difficult. They change formulas without changing part numbers. Benoit Thibault from the Presto space was able to identify U-matic cassettes, same part number, four different profiles, chemical profiles on the same part number. You have to rank importance as well as risk. Manufacturers, I had one manufacturer, Ampex, one of the people on the Ampex patent, tell me design life of the tapes for 10 to 20 years. Huh? Wish he had told us that at the time. Oldest tapes are approaching 60 years. Some 30-year-old tapes are difficult to play, more so than the 60-year-old ones. Player obsolescence is now. Studer is supporting the A807 through 2010. The Otari 5050, not one of my favorite players, is the only one that still seems to be sold. And no new top-of-the-line cassette players have been made for 10 or 12 years. We cannot really reliably predict the life of tape. It can be batch specific, can't rely on what's written on the box. Most tapes are now past their design life, and the past storage history is unknown and unknowable. You can't ask the tape where it's been. Now, but measurement, Bradshaw is thinking, and he's being a gem, he's doing this for the industry. He's already like working 80-hour weeks on bringing out LTO4. But he's still running tests in his time and thinking about this, and I think we all owe him a deep debt of gratitude. He thinks that the TG may be the indicator that we wish for. It's not trivial to measure because you have to measure the mag coating's mechanical properties off the base film. So you have to take off this very thin coating and measure how it flexes at different temperatures. And we don't think that a simple pool test kit with an eyedropper and a few chemicals is likely to tell us the future. Ongoing research, Presto Space, the CCI, Canadian Conservation Institute, has evaluated optical media and is planning on freezing tapes. And I don't know all the details, but I keep hearing great things are going to be done at LOC. So what to do? Optimize storage conditions, prioritize copying, copy also known as reformatting, store multiple copies using geographically diverse repositories, two different unrelated media, develop a media evaluation for the copies, and a refresh plan for the copies and stick to it. So when? You should do that now. If you wish to preserve it, you must start the program now. Not all tapes are failing, but do you know which ones are? Don't delay starting. Do it when?
Now.
So now, what's in the typical, do I have about three more minutes?
Oh, yeah, you're good.
What's in typical archives? This was done for public radio archives was the impetus for these next few slides, but I think they apply to a lot. So we have the good files and CDs. They're not in any immediate risk. Bad. We have reels and records. And I know Doug is going to tell us not all records are bad, and I agree with him, but there are bad records, like acetates, right?
Yep.
Okay. Just want to make sure that I got it right. I mean, there are some acetates that are delaminated. Lacquers.
Lacquers, yes. Thank you, Mike.
Sorry. I've been with the collector side too long.
Mm.
Then there's the ugly. DATs, cassettes, PCMF1, and minidisc. For the ugly, DAT is dead. PCMF1 is petrified. Okay. Cassettes are a carcass. And minidisc is moribund. Don't assume any of these formats will be playable in 10 or 20 years. Oh, yeah, I said that. The bad. Records are what they are. They're still playable, and they're not decaying. Most of them are not decaying. What? Well, so would we say that only some of them are not decaying? Or we'll change most to some the next time. Tapes are decaying. We also have machine obsolescence, operator obsolescence, and tape degradation. The good, CDs should be playable for 50-plus years. The disc lifetime probably greater for the gold phthalocyanidine CDs. They're fragile, but they're easily cloned. They support the shelf storage model, which some small archives seem to want, but they're limited to 16-bit 44.1, as at least in the audio mode. You could put files on them, but would you? Because there isn't enough storage capacity. Better would be to move everything to file storage within an IT infrastructure, and with automatic backups, little manual intervention, but management of the overall systems required and required and required in perpetuity. Topology would be spinning disk and LTO3 or soon LTO4 tape, and then making sure that you do the metadata properly, but I don't talk metadata. There are lots of other people here who do. Security, multiple disk copies, multiple tape copies, offsite storage, and don't forget storage on different plates away from fault lines. And this was, I gave this slide first in San Francisco, so it was a little more important to say that there than here. What archive format? Broadcast wave. A terabyte holds about 1,000 channel hours of 9624 wave. Other formats. Don't try and mix formats. I would say that within broadcast wave, supporting multiple bit sample rates may be acceptable. But you would down convert for delivery to whatever the delivery format du jour is. And if you get something that isn't a B-Wave file in, you should convert it to the B-Wave file format to store in your archive. Maybe don't upconvert a 44.1 to 96, but still store it as a B-Wave because don't rely on long-term codec availability, because the codecs would all have to be migrated to new operating systems in perpetuity if you have that, and that's why I would suggest putting everything into B-Wave format. Storage overview. Now, this is a key thing. Archival storage, these are sort of the steps, must be understood, funded, designed, organized, populated, and then managed in perpetuity. It is the antithesis of shelf storage. Don't risk losing audio material. Don't trust dedicated formats long term. By dedicated formats, I mean audio specific or video specific. Nothing is certain but change. IT data loss rarely happens, although we just had a magazine that shouldn't have lost something lose a lot. And IT migrates for long-term storage, and data management is really well understood. The content matters to you. Do not rely on old tape. new data tape is fine, and I stress data. Don't re-record audio tape. As long as there's a plan to refresh the data tape over time. One thing has been my mantra since I first started talking on this subject is, just because you can't play the tape doesn't mean it's not recoverable. And tapes are not getting better with age. That's it. Any questions? Yes?
Wait a minute, hold on.
Got
nobody move.
I was wondering if you have any opinion on the baking of sticky shed tapes versus Charlie Richardson's method of stripping the back coating. And I have a follow-up to that after you ask it, after you answer it.
Well, I think I said that I'm very nervous about Charlie's stripping the back coating, and I'm not sure it solves the degradation of the mag binder. But, I mean, I don't want to throw a stone at any process that works. I just don't think I see myself doing it in the near or even distant future.
One concern I have about Charlie Richardson's method is that since most of these tapes are, or a large percentage of them, are Ampex 406 and 456, those tapes, even with the back coating, were incredibly prone to print through. I used to do editing projects on 456, and I'd have an editing project on the machine, some on the take-up and part of it on the supply reel. I would go to lunch, and the tape would be printed through when I come back from lunch. And that's with back coating. If you strip the back coating off, how much more serious is that problem going to be?
Well, I think Kevin Bradley has solved that problem, the perceived problem, for both of those in two ways. I think they're interleaving leader tape. Yes, we have one.
I could tell you specifically that there are reel-to-reel tapes where the oxide just peels right off. Specifically, they're from around 1957. There are Gene Shepherd tapes that the whole series of some of his earliest shows from 56 and 57, the whole collection is like that. And I ran across about a 10-minute recording in the Sam Levinson archive. It was just by itself on a reel that the oxide just started peeling off. I immediately hit stop.
Do you know what the tape was?
No, that's the problem. It was there by itself.
In all probability, it was Scotch 111 made about 1952-53 because RCA wound up with a bunch of those reels. And they block terribly, and they've got the T6, the rubbery consistency on the oxide side.
The oxide comes off.
It blocks. It just completely comes off. Yeah.
Imperfect shape.
Like my cassette.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And the thing is, though, that the they were using a lot of Reeves Soundcraft.
Right.
That stuff's fine.
Yep. No, and audio tape seems to have lasted pretty well. But all the 111 I've seen, some of it's starting to smell a little vinegary, but I haven't seen any shed.
Mm.
In boxes that I think, it says 111 on the box, and it sort of looks like 111, so I assume that it's probably 111.
Yeah, I asked Max. Max Schmid's the one that has the Gene Shepherd tapes, and I don't think he knows. I think they were in plain
boxes. There was a batch of Scotch from that period, and even I think over at Columbia Records they had a problem with a number of them, and also a problem was the slitting in that period, uneven with the slitters would go out of would not stay in place.
I had some half inch tape this week that was Ampex that was slit really badly and had crinkled edges, and was jamming in guides.
There you go. That's it.
Hi, Richard. I wonder if there's any other kind of processes that you found that do work for tapes that have loss of lubricant and things like that. I've purchased a dehydrator to work with my tapes that are sticking. But I think as far as my boss is concerned, if I order a refrigerator also, I might as well order a couch and a hot tub and all kinds of great things for my...
Well, the AES paper, and if you send me an email, richard@richardhess.com, I will email you the PDF of it. If you ask for me to do that, because if you send me the blank email, I won't know what it is. But I've spent a lot of time, and Doug and I have spent a lot of time pouring stuff on tape. And I really want to, I was a real proponent of loss of lubricant up until about a year ago. And it's not loss of lubricant. When you do a gas chromatograph analysis, the 500 weight 500 grams per mole weight stuff is still there in the spike. It's there. The problem is the other stuff that I've described. When we saw the lubricant, what we were calling loss of lubricant tapes, I mean, I have a graph of Sony PR150 that was the poster child of loss of lubricant, and we thought that's what it was. But this glass transition temperature, T sub G, is really what seems to be what's happening based on everything that we can put together at this point. And it's not loss of lubricant, but I have tried siloxane silicones of varying weights. Doug has poured all sorts of stuff on the tapes, and Doug came to just doing the low pressure, low tension, and cleaning it that we talked about as the option for 175. But for PR150, we haven't found anything that where I did a tape where I was able to lubricate it with decamethyl, whatever, it's in the paper, and it came through in three or four pass, you know, segments, but running it through like a machine that was configured to apply a thin layer to the whole tape, by the time you'd done it, it evaporated, and it's not a pre-treatment. It's like Marie O'Connell's wet playing, but the fridge seems to be a much better solution, I'm sorry to say. I mean, are you in a place where it's cold in the winter?
Florida.
And when it's cold, it's 100% humidity, right?
Yeah, these tapes used to live on the banks of the Suwannee River, so we've got that too.
Well, before, it may be cheaper to send me a reel and I'll try it for you. I didn't measure it. Well, I have an AA10, as I said, and a Dragon now, in Nakamichi Dragon in the fridge, and also my C2. I'm sorry? Yes. This is actually for cassette. It's very interesting. Cassettes suffer from this probably more than reels. There's a whole batch of Agfa duplicator stock tape that suffered from this screeching right out of the box, practically. I think there's another one.
So we just have time for a couple of more. Got one over here, perhaps? Yes? No?
Richard, I just wanted to go back to one of your screens that went past rather quickly. One of the points you brought up was operator obsolescence, and that seems
yes.
That seems to me to be one of the single biggest issues in the whole question of tape handling, identification of problems, etc. Since there are a decreasing number of people who have really worked with tape when it was the dominant medium, and
well,
know how it behaves, know how to handle it, not be afraid of it. That's one of the things I've noticed in working with younger practitioners, that they've somehow been indoctrinated in a way that says, God, you know, it's a fragile artifact. It's a medium, you know, and so a lot of times they waste a lot of time and they actually run the risk of more damage by being afraid of it than by knowing how to handle it.
Yeah, well, I'm in my middle 50s, and I'm very honored to have people in their 70s like Jay McKnight and Joe Dundovic and others take an interest in increasing my knowledge, and I feel that I owe them the responsibility of passing it on as much as I can to people younger than myself, because it really is it is a problem, because I don't think there are very many people under 50 who really have a good sense for handling this stuff. I mean, we used to throw this stuff around, and and now you're right. The archivists come out with white gloves, and it's an artifact. And do I need to put the stuff in acid-free? Do I need to put the reels in acid-free boxes? No. Transfer it. Digitize it. It's self-destructing. Forget about the box.
And replacing hubs, for instance. They're
yes.
still holding an enormous amount of tape at places like LC on slotted aluminum hubs. And, if you go if you have a tape out, let's say, and you get a open splice at a piece of paper leader, and you repair it, and you have to lift it off the hub in order to get it intact, they were terrified of the idea that you could actually touch the surface of the tape. And I said, honey, how are you going to get it off if you don't touch the surface of the tape? And, I showed her how to lift it off with a razor blade, and I said, let's Let's get the hub replaced as long as we're at it.
Right.
And this was terra incognita to them.
Well, the thing, I think the thing that's really important is if they take the tape and if you're going to play the tape, digitize it, please, because it may not go back on the hub as well as it came off. With all the warping issues that have gone on over time.
And that's another technique, the so-called B-wind, where you take an acetate tape in particular and simply flex it in a different way and store it in that mode for a while, and you will often solve some of the worst pack problems.
Yep.
All right, in the interest of time, let's see if we can just squeeze in. I would love to hear what George has to say, and then we have one more up here, I think, if we can squeeze them both in under 5 minutes.
I just had a really quick question. Dealing with a large collection of 1970s, 407, 456 stuff, and our institution doesn't have a budget to transfer any of it, would you suggest that putting it in a cool environment is probably the best short-term solution for at least slowing down the problem?
Yeah, I would go at the cold end of the AES recommendation, a cold and dry end. Because that will give you the lowest specific humidity, and it's the humidity that's hurting. I have a chart on my website that you can refer to.
Great.
That summarizes the temperatures. I think it's like 8 degrees C and 30% RH. So if you can head down in that direction.
Not that much different, actually, than microfilm.
Right, but you don't want to take tape right now. I cannot recommend taking it below 8 degrees C, even if I think that that's right for acetate. I can't do that until the Canadian Conservation Institute tests.
All right, thank you.
We just want to say how much we appreciate the enthusiasm and the leadership that you've approached this problem with, because it's something we're seeing a lot of. I'm curious to know what the sample set is. How many tapes have you been able to work with to see the variety so we would span perhaps multiple iterations of the same model number, and whether any of your testing has been able to include controls for the testing, and whether there's been any peer review publication in any of these studies that you've been doing.
The peer review is happening now with the AES journal, so if you see this in the AES, it will have been peer reviewed. If it doesn't come out in the AES, it failed the peer review, so I think that's what we're waiting for now. And one of the challenges I had was that everybody who's eligible to peer review it also helped me on it. So, and I credited them all, and so they're having trouble finding someone to review it. The sample size has been as low as 2 tapes for the 175 and PR150. It worked with them. It then worked with I think Mark Durenberger had about 50 tapes that he did out in Minneapolis. Doug, then, with the tension thing, how many tapes did you do, Doug?
Maybe 30 or 40.
30 or 40. But they have been different groups, and the one that Indiana did was 1 tape, but it worked also for the cold playback. We are looking for more feedback on this and more peer review. I'm not saying that this is foolproof or guaranteed. I'm saying it works.
All right, I'm so sorry, but we're already running 5 minutes behind, and believe me, I think every person in this room could ask Richard questions, and we'll probably have to have a Richard Hess day next year if we can convince him to do that. Provide you with some extra coffee. So let's give a big hand for Richard Hess.